Hi there, my name is Hatzi and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And as always, it's an honor to be here. And today we're going to talk about the sixth step. We've talked about... What?
I need to get to the sixth step, so I'm very happy to...
Good, I'm glad it's funny.
Double speaker meeting. It's going to be a round robin.
It's going to be fun tonight. We talked about the preparatory part of this program, which are the first three steps. What is my problem? What's my answer to my problem? And now that I know the answer to the problem, can I trust that this thing works? First three steps. The fourth step, looked inside and found what the reasons for my resentments were. And I realized that the reasons of my resentments lie within me. And in the fifth step, I shared this, not with myself, but with my higher power, but with another human being. And I started the road of recovery. That's what happens between four and nine. Those six steps. The principle of the fifth step is integrity. The principle of the sixth step is willingness. Integrity comes from a word, integer, which means whole number. Integrity implies you become a whole person. Step four and five are the beginning on this road. Step six and seven, oddly enough, don't necessarily look inside and try to find what's wrong with me, but they try to find more of a solution of what I have found that is wrong with me in four and five. Before I get there, a small history, as I can see it, of how AA came to be. Prohibition, 1920 through 1933, was supposed to deal with alcoholism. It was supposed to eradicate the abuse of alcohol. Absolutely did not work. But the reason why there was prohibition is because this disease is much older than AA. It's been around forever. It crosses all societies, all gender. It crosses all borders. It has no regard to age and or upbringing or background. It touches everybody who is liable to get the disease. So there, for a long time, societies have tried to find a way to deal with alcoholism. And alcoholism was a strange disease because there was so little success and so little knowledge on how to deal with it. And the sufferers of the disease were so obviously not capable of finding recovery. The lack of recovery reflected on the sufferer. It reflected on the person. And it was looked upon as a disease of lack of willpower, lack of strength, lack of ethics, lack of morals, whatever. So the disease became embroiled and looked upon as a shameful thing. Families were shameful if there was somebody amongst them who had this disease and didn't know how to deal with it. And the disease carried forward, and those who had it tried to hide, and the families tried to hide them or disown them, just leave them, get them away. So when after the prohibition, after 1933, after there was the Oxford Group, a group that had six steps, six ideas on how to deal with our problem, with our affliction. And it was successful to a certain point. Bill W. became involved with the Oxford Group and then started to learn that there was more to it than just the six steps, and the 12 steps became the 12 steps as we know them, the 12 principles became part of it, the 12 traditions, etc., and the program grew. In the first years, they realized that they had found a possible answer to this question of how to deal with addiction. An answer that nobody had ever seen before. No society had come up with an answer to the problem of addiction. And here were these addicts and alcoholics and that were finding a way somehow to stay clean and sober. So The fact that that was found in the early 30s and the mid 30s, we discount what we have here. We discount it. We think it's normal. It's been around for as long as I live, for as long as most of us live. We know AA has been around, and there are offshoots. There's NA, there's CA, there's other A's, and etc. But we discount the fact that it's here, and we think it has always been part of it. It has absolutely not been part of us for a long time. It is a new thing in our society. It's a new thing historically. And the fact that it had success for the beginners was a phenomenal idea. It's like they found the gold. They found that one thing that society could. It's like the answer to cancer. Nobody found the answer to alcoholism. And here were these people that were staying clean and sober by just being with each other and with certain principles, certain ideas, certain ways of working, certain ideals about a higher power, and it worked. So the beginning people, the beginning groups of AA thought, this is such a great thing. This has to become public knowledge. We have to tell the world about this. We have to put it in newspapers. We have to have special groups. We have to educate all the people in the world that this is possible. We have to tell the doctors and the hospitals, and we have to get special AA hospitals. We have to get special things and radio programs. And television was not there as much, but radio programs specifically about educating people about this thing that they found, our solution. It got to such a frenzy that at one point, a liquor company that made whiskey, came up with the brilliant idea to hire somebody from AA with long-term sobriety, at least long-term at the time, and it'd be their spokesperson. And he would educate the people how to drink, because he knew how not to drink, and anyway, he didn't drink, but he could. Anyway, brilliant idea. That there would be somebody from us who would stand up for whoever this company was and say, this is how you should drink, and I used to drink like that, and you shouldn't do it, and therefore buy this bourbon, whatever. But they found somebody, and they were willing to pay him good money to do so. And this person thought about it and went to the main office in New York and asked, is this something that I should do or not? The answer was, you're legally, we cannot stop you from taking the job. But if you become a spokesperson for a liquor company, then the name of AA will be associated with a liquor company. The name of AA will be associated with an outside venture, with an outside idea that has nothing to do with us. Not only that, they'll pay you. And one day they're going to say to you, this is what we want you to say. Or that is what, or you can't say this. Or no, you can't talk about God. Or you can't talk about a higher power. And all of a sudden, you're going to be at their beck and call of what your program is going to be. So we say, as AA, don't do it. Because it will ultimately destroy our values. It will destroy what we stand for. It will destroy our strength, which is, it's just us. Nobody helps us. Nobody told you to come here. Nobody told you to show up. It's just us. We do this out of our own free will. So the sixth tradition says, excuse me, an AA group ought never endorse or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Our primary purpose is to bring the message to another suffering alcoholic. I like that sentence. Lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary problem. So here as a institution, as nearly a company, as a group of people, as an ensemble, our institution was subject to be seduced by money, by property, by ideas of grandiosity, by whatever, by outside influences. And they realized, if we allow this, If we allow this to happen, then AA as a whole will cease to exist, because we are not going to be able to say what we want to say. We're not going to be able to think what we think we should be thinking. We're not going to be able to teach the steps as we think they should be taught, because we're going to be subject to other people who have put either money or fame at our doorstep. And as a group, we're going to be subject to their beck and call, and we cannot allow this. This is why the sixth tradition was placed there. I find it interesting that the sixth tradition is next to the sixth step. The sixth step says, we're entirely ready to have God remove us, to have God remove all these defects of character. Which defects of character, first of all? Well, the ones we talked about, the ones we discovered in 4, the ones we talked about in 5. Those are the defects of character. Defects of character are the result of the seduction of our desires. Not only the seduction of our desires, the withholding of the satisfaction of our desires. I want more of whatever I want more of, and I want it now. And if I can't get it now, you will deal with me one way or the other, because I'm going to get it. See?
I can't relate.
Like my sponsor says, the bottle comes in many disguises. Sometimes it's a pretty girl. Sometimes it's white powder. Sometimes it's just another job. Sometimes it's the greed to put more money into a job than I should be able to. Sometimes it's an attitude. It doesn't matter. It's whatever makes me feel different from myself. It's whatever stops me from feeling and living me as I am. Because I never thought that I was enough. I never thought that I fitted in. I never thought I was part of. I was never good enough. Not in the family I grew up in, not the school I went to, nor the schools I got kicked out of. I was not good enough for any of them. The only people I felt comfortable with was people just like you that I found in the street. You wanted to get high and drunk, I wanted to do it with you. And that was fine. So, it says, have God remove all these defects of character. What's interesting about that step is that it's the same energy that is used in the second step. The second step, have remove me from this insanity. What am I asking there? To have this insanity taken away. The insanity of my lifestyle. The insanity of my using. What am I doing there? I'm trying to find a higher power that takes away this insanity, that takes away the way I used to live and the way I went crazy. That higher power somehow was capable of doing this. How and the mechanisms, I don't know how it happened. I just know that the moment I stopped believing my own story and started to believe in somebody else's story who came ahead of me, maybe sometimes only 2 months or 3 months, maybe a year or 2 years, it doesn't matter. Somebody who was clean and sober and looked me in the eye and then said, you know what? I got 4 months. I don't know how I did it, but I did it. That was for me when I showed up, a person that I could look at and say, really? Is that possible for me too? And I came to believe that a power greater than I could restore me to sanity. But it's not just that I came to believe. I saw it happen on everybody else. I had not just to believe that it happened for you. It had to happen for me. I had to believe that this power didn't just do it for you. If I applied all these steps in the program, if I applied what you guys did, then perhaps I could get the benefits as well. And I never thought I could. First of all, I never thought there was a higher power much higher than I. You know? You ask me a question, I knew the answer. And if I didn't know the answer, I'd give you one nonetheless. And if you argue with me, I knew better. I always had a better answer. My answer was always so good that at the age of 35, I ended up in AA. That's how good it was. You know? And that was probably the smartest thing I ever did. But it's because I stopped having the answers. So the second step, I invoked a power greater than me. I listened to it and thought, perhaps it can take me out of this insane world that I'm in. And I can find something else. That same power is used in the sixth step. To remove my shortcomings. To remove my character defects. It's that same power that somehow I'm going to have to find and understand and deal with and ask it on a daily basis. Please help me not to react this way. Please help me not to think this way. Please help me not to do these things. Ultimately, through having been doing the fourth and the fifth step, I became able and capable of predicting my behavior. I could see what would happen if I did a certain thing. You know, it's like as easy as if I hit somebody, I'm probably going to get hit back. You know, so if I don't hit that person, I'm probably not going to get hit back. That's a brilliant idea. You know, I came up with it all myself. But that's what happened. My idea of the world changed because I could see that certain things I did provoked other actions. Certain things I did became as a result, and it always backfired on me. Always. My attitude created behavior that created a bad situation, and it caused a bad emotion that created a bad attitude that created bad behavior. It's a vicious cycle. These three are hand in hand. It's sad that we have this disease of the attitudes, and it is a disease of the attitudes. My attitude was always bad. And not that I thought it was bad. I just thought that whatever happened to me was your fault. But that's an attitude or a resentment. You know, and I didn't understand. I just did not understand the key feature of that, which is that if my problem is not inside of me, then nor can the solution be inside of me. And once I understood that part, I had to understand that whatever happens to me, whatever, and there is no exception to this rule, it is all my fault. Whether it's fair or not, whether it happened to me as a child, whether it happened to me as an adult, it doesn't matter. Because if I want to be in charge of my future, if I want to be in charge of my destiny, which I believe I can be, then I should take control of what happens to me and how I react to it. So when something happens to me that I am not happy with, and there's a couple of things right now that are happening in my life that I'm absolutely unhappy with, there's nothing else I can do with it than deal with it. But I know one thing for certain. I brought it upon me. I did it. There's a contract that I signed with somebody that is costing me a lot of money. I wish it weren't so. But it is so. I can try to get out of it. I can try to deal with it. I can try to manipulate it. I can do things to that guy. Whatever. The end result is, I signed that contract. I did it to myself. I can be pissed off at him because he's enforcing it. It doesn't matter. I'm going to have to deal with it. One way or the other. I have found this, though. It's a little rule that I like. If I ignore reality, it will always end up working against me. Always. If I ignore the truth of the matter and don't take the responsibility for what happened to me, it'll backfire on me. It just will. Just always has and always will. You see, I believe that we are capable of creating our own future. It all starts in here. The thought starts, the action happens, and the results in the world. It all starts in here. So, if I have the power to think, and if I have the power to do with my thinking as I like, if the result of my being is thoughts that create actions that create reality, then I should be able to create the reality that I want, as long as I take full responsibility for every facet of it. Now that's a hard rule, because it means there's no excuses. And that's how I regard the sixth step. There is no excuse. for what I do and what I have done and what happens to me. It is all my fault. I'd like it not to be that way. But it's something I can't argue with. It's something that I cannot overcome. So is it a coincidence that the sixth step and the sixth tradition are together? As a group, as an institution, we are being seduced, or we were being seduced, to get involved with other people, with other groups, with other institutions, with money, all people that wanted to help us and think we can use this great idea and we can make it work for us. On the same level, as a person, I get seduced by money, by prestige. I get seduced by things that I would like to get, but I can't get right now, or I want more of. So the sixth step, the sixth tradition, creates the framework again, which within which we are safe to do the sixth step. It creates the safety as a organization within which we can do the steps that we will prosper through. It wasn't necessarily an idea that this thing of AA would grow to what it is today. They did realize that they stumbled upon something that was unknown. It was novel. It was new. The whole idea of anonymity came from the fact that people said, if we put our names out in the public, we'll get overrun by the multitudes of people that want to know how we did it. So we'll stay anonymous to protect ourselves. That's the idea behind the anonymity, so that we would not be plagued by everybody that wanted to know. Now, it used to be difficult to come into AA. In the 60s, in the 70s, you just didn't show up and walk in. You had to be introduced. Not only did you have to be introduced, you had to deal with old-timers that were questioning you and wonder if you're really a problem drinker or not, whether you could be part of our group, whether you had enough pain and enough sorrow to go through the problems and go through the quote-unquote therapy that we went through. I went to a therapeutic community called Phoenix House in 1973, whose idea and basic founding principle came from a place called Synanon, which used to be in California. Synanon's idea was the world is screwed up, you go to Synanon, you never leave. You become a lifetimer, they used to call it, because you don't want to go back there. That backfired because people did want to leave, and when they left, they were being chased and being... Anyway, it backfired. But the whole idea of Synanon was, very much like AA, you want to come and be part of us? Why? Why? What happened to you that you think you should be part of us? And if you cannot tell me what your basic need is, why you have to show up, then don't show up. We don't want you here. Phoenix House worked the same way. Excuse me. 40 years ago, in October, I went to Phoenix House. And they did the same thing to me. They set me down. And there were like 25 people. It was a little room in a little farm in Holland. And it's a little room upstairs. And it was like scared the absolute bejesus out of me. Excuse me. And they say, why are you here? Why did you show up? What is it you want from us? And I couldn't tell them. I could not come up with why I showed up. Whereas the answer was simple. I didn't see it. The answer was I needed help. And I had to convince them ultimately that I needed help, which is I did. And I convinced them and I stayed. But it was a grueling process. The idea behind this is that we only want people in this program that are going to flourish, that need the program, that want to be here. This is not for those who just need it. It really works only for those who want it. So, AA used to be the same way. You just couldn't walk up and come in and say, I want this program. No, you had to qualify yourself. You had to show what you did and what was happening and why you needed their help and what it is that you were going to do about it. And if, at the time, if you're allowed in, sit down and shut up. Whatever you have to say, we don't want to hear it. Because it doesn't make sense anyway. Phoenix House was very much the same way. And there's a lot of truth in it. When I came from the street, I was 20 years old, I came from the streets, and I thought I had all the answers. Yeah, that's why I went to Phoenix House. That's how many answers I had. So they told me to shut up and listen, and which was difficult. I didn't like that. You know, I thought I was the answer to many things. You know, so I came to Phoenix House, I did the work, we did very much the same thing as the steps. Their problem was is that they separated addiction in two fields, either an addict or an alcoholic, not both. So when I graduated, I did graduate. It's the only thing I graduated from. So when I graduated from Phoenix House, and they gave me this little piece of paper saying, you are now an ex-addict, I drank that day. Why? Because I was not an alcoholic. You know? But anybody looking at my case history would have seen that I drank all the time. My first love was alcohol. My last kiss before I sobered up was alcohol. It always was there. It either started me out or it helped me or it stopped me. Whatever. It was always alcohol. It was always available. So the idea that I was not an alcoholic is strange. We knew we were alcoholics. They just tried to classify us. And we said, yeah, go right ahead. Okay, I'm just a junkie. Yeah, okay. You get drinking privilege. Okay, good. Great. And I drank to get high. And then I got high. Just forget it. So, we end up at the sixth step. We have looked at ourselves. We've shared it with somebody else. We end up at the sixth step, where we were entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And we ask, in some way, somehow, to ask our higher power to deal with all those things that caused discomfort in my life. Whatever they may be. It could be as simple as driving on the road and the guy gives me the finger. Or cuts me off. Or a pretty woman in the car next door to me. And I do something stupid. Whatever. Simple things. I have found it is usually the small, simple things that have the greatest, that create the greatest problem in my life. It's the big things I know what to do with. The small things I don't. So, how do I stop reacting immediately? How do I ask my higher power, please make me stop doing this behavior so I don't end up with the results of my character defects? How do I do this? Do I pray? Do I sit down? Do I stop? Do I stop driving? Do I stop looking at girls? Do I not give him the finger back? Do I don't cut him off? Don't shoot him? Whatever. You know, what is it that I have to do? And for me, it was, I had no idea. Now, the sixth and the seventh step are really one action. You think about it, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. To become entirely ready is like making a decision, which happens right now. Decision is done. To become entirely ready, okay, I'm entirely ready. It's a decision. And then humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. But because it is really a one-step thing, it is separated for reflection. It allows us to separate willingness from action. It allows us to separate our mental process and become ready to do something. It is something that the mind likes to do. It likes to get ready for something, think about it, talk about it, discuss it, write about it, mull it over, maybe not, maybe yes, who knows what. And then the seventh step steps in. It's interesting, by the way, that the seventh step starts with humbly. It's the only time the word humble comes up. It doesn't tell us how to become humble. It just tells us that obviously, if we've done step 1 through 6, that humility has become a process or a character trait that we've come to understand. We'll talk about that next week. But to separate the willingness to get rid of the rest of our character defects by the action is so that we can look back and say, what are my character? All these defects of character. Well, they're already mentioned in the sixth tradition. They're the same character defects that AA tried to defend us against. Lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Our primary purpose of AA is to bring the message to somebody else. Our primary purpose for me is to stay clean and sober. So I will stop being seduced by money, by power. I will stop being seduced by all those things that attract me. It doesn't mean that I cannot have a girlfriend. It doesn't mean that I cannot have a good job or become wealthy. What it means is that it doesn't take over who I am. It doesn't change my personality. If anything, my personality and my being dictates how I deal with those parts of my life. They have found, and I have found, that the presence of a higher power is absolutely necessary in this process. And the reason why, in the second step, it already talks about it. It gave me at least an idea that at some point you're going to have to talk about God, whether you like it or not. And I didn't like it. I didn't want to talk about God. I didn't hold the whole idea that I had to believe that a power greater than myself could restore my sanity. That means that it's there. I mean, I just didn't like the whole. Nobody asked me to believe in Jesus or voodoo or whatever when I showed up. But the whole idea that the second step talks about a power greater than myself, and then in I just didn't like it. And the whole idea that in the third step they talk about God, I knew they were going to do more of that stuff. You know, there, at some point, it's going to show up. And sure enough, there it is, 6 and 7. You know, and I thought I was going to be safe from it. And this doesn't mean that I don't like religion or I don't like Prince. But what I needed when I showed up, what I wanted, is a simple program. Just a simplicity. And I was lucky enough to find a sponsor and a group of people that gave me the simple tools to come and show up every day, day after day, and do very simple things that I was able to do. I didn't want to have a spiritual program. I'd done enough spiritual crap with acid. I mean, believe me. I mean, I've dropped enough acid to have seen God too many times, you know, and he didn't look that good. At least then he didn't. So I was glad nobody pushed it on me. What they did push on me was, come back tomorrow. Don't use in between meetings. Don't drink. Get a sponsor and do the steps. Start doing the steps. If you don't understand the steps, ask about it. Become part of a fellowship. Try to associate yourself with people just like you. Learn to pray. Learn to meditate. The two are very related. And do it over and over again every day. And I did those things. In the beginning, they were novel, they were new, and then the novelty wore off, and I kept doing them. I remember the first time that I felt a true result of doing this simple discipline of these things day in, day in, day out. I may have talked about it before, but I'll just tell you again. I had maybe 16, 17, 18 months, a year and a half. I was married, I had a job, I had a home. My business was, my own business, which was not doing well. And I was married to a woman and our relationship wasn't doing well. And I just didn't like anything in my life. And I had to go to these stupid meetings and show up and talk to a sponsor. I mean, I just didn't like doing it. The only thing I knew is that I had no option. I had to do it. And everybody was happy and laughing, and I was not happy and I was not laughing. And I didn't come early, and I didn't stay late. I didn't do it. I was not going to do it. And my biggest fear was sitting in a meeting, and somebody would call on me. And I didn't know what to say. That was a novel experience. So I remember picking up my son from after school. And I drive home, which is in Houston, Texas. And I drive home, and I take different roads because I don't want to drive by the bars. And that. I drive home, and I'm listening to music, and my son's babbling in the back in his chair. La, 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 la. And I felt good. I just felt good. Just something happened. And I had this little warm, fuzzy feeling inside of me. Not high, not elated. I just felt good. And I'd never felt that before. I never had the sensation outside of using chemicals and alcohol of just feeling good. And I remember this thought. I remember it was like a voice in my head. I said, you know what? Maybe this thing can work. And I got just this splinter of hope. Just this tiny piece of hope that maybe this would work. You know, and I drove home and there was my wife. And she's in the program too. She is. God bless her. You know, and I think she's been clean and sober all this time too. So good for her. So that was the beginning of the idea that maybe there could be a future for me in this thing. And after that, I think that whole idea of how I felt changed the way I looked at things. And I started understanding that the idea of a power greater than myself, you know, I always thought it interesting that alcohol is called spirits. That's a higher power. You know, it's just of a lower level. A higher power of a lower level. You know? But I always thought it is, they're spirits. Why? Because they change you. They change the way you are. And Alcoholics Anonymous has changed me. It has changed the way I am. It has changed the way I react. And I actually work. My sponsor says, life is lived in the sixth and the seventh step. That's where it happens. You know, we may have resentments, we may have guilt, we may have shame. But whatever I do with people around me is predicated on how well I do step six and seven. Why? Because it determines how I react to you and with you. It determines how my actions are and how I'm going to react to you reacting to me. And that will change my life. It will actually be my life. I never understood that my life is no more than the result of you reacting to me. I didn't like my life. Well, guess what? I learned real early on, do something different will happen. Mm-hmm. Whatever. It doesn't matter I'm doing something right. Do it different. The reaction will tell me if it's done right or not. So I learned that using a higher power quickly, whenever it occurs, and ask, please, Lord, please let this and this happen. Or guy cuts me off and gives me the finger. Instead of blinding him with my lights and running him off the road, which I would do, I say, let him get home safely. And then, all of a sudden, I don't have to deal with the anger. Because where do I go with the anger? Where do I go with the upsetness that he caused me? He caused me. Interesting word choice, isn't it? I feel something, it's your fault. I'm upset, you did it. Why? Because you cut me off. It's that resentment thing. It's built into us. We're taught. Our whole educational system is like this. Our politics are like this. I didn't do it. They did it. I inherited this. No, I didn't know about it. Really? Are you kidding me? Where is the idea that I'm responsible for my life and for what I do? Where is that gone? That's why we're the lucky ones. We really are. We're the lucky ones. Not only did we survive the mayhem we caused around us, which is lucky, believe me, it's not because I'm so smart, but now I'm getting taught something that I actually can, it's practical. I can do something with it every day so that my day will be better. Not only that, those that I'm with, those that touch my lives in one way or the other, hopefully some of that will spark off onto them. So that they as well will do the same thing. That's the gift. The idea that the primary purpose to give this message to other alcoholics who suffer, it doesn't have to be a drinking alcoholic. It could be somebody sitting in the back or in the front or in the side, whatever, it doesn't matter. It could be somebody outside who was afraid to come into the meeting, whatever. It could be my friend who went out yesterday. Who knows? You know. But it gives me something. It changes me. The fact that I now do have a higher power, that I do embrace spirituality, I meditate every morning, and I find that spot inside of me excuse me, where it's quiet. It gets sometimes so quiet and so still that I stop feeling my skin and it becomes transparent. And the border between myself and the outside world dissipates. And I don't breathe through my nose. It's my body just breathes in. Quiet. And I love that spot. And in that quiet moment, sometimes things happen that I can't foresee. Ideas, thoughts, or just the grace of serenity, which we call the love of God, whatever you want to call it, it doesn't matter. I know that I could never, ever have gotten to that point without doing the work to get there, which, and the work to get there is self-discovery, self-examination, finding out who I am, why I react in certain ways. Why do I get angry? How come I react to fear this way? How come you're not going to see me vulnerable? All those things. And I've worked at those things over and over, and the work never stops. The only way in which I will find out whether I'm successful at my work is through my meditations and in my relationship with others. Again, the meditations is where I receive inspiration from a higher power. What I do with it is with you. And with you is where the miracle happens, not with the higher power. We are given the gift of receiving thoughts that sometimes don't come from nowhere but a higher power. What we do with them is between us. And that we call, when we change the world, when we change ourselves, when we change the way we look at things, when we change another person, that's the miracle. When you see the idea in somebody's eyes, what I had at 18 months, you think this thing will work? Really? When this guy said, who had 4 months, I didn't want to do this, but I'm doing it no matter what. Really? You think I can? Little miracles always become big miracles. So, the sixth tradition gives us the freedom to work the sixth step. As a group, as a whole, we're just as susceptible to get seduced by the same things that a person gets seduced by. That's why the sixth tradition is next to the sixth step. Of course, an institution doesn't pray. A company doesn't meditate. But we do. And we are part of it. So as long as we do it, the sixth tradition will stay alive. Because it can only stay alive if we do the work for it. If we find a way inside of ourselves to not get seduced by what we want to get. Right now, more and more. Now. So again, I always end with this. I am blessed by this gift. We are blessed by this gift. It is something that came to me from nowhere without expectation. I showed up because I wanted the bleeding to stop. Instead, I was given something that I didn't know existed. And it's been given to me day in, day out by you, for which I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Okay, I've asked a friend to come up and do the chips.